as we look together at John 18, it strikes me as something that is full of a whole load of irony. That again and again we see a sense of irony as we go through not just the passage that we just had read to us, but actually the whole of chapter 18. We'll focus mainly on the bit that Christine just read, but we'll have a look at some other pieces as well. Sometimes we use the term irony quite loosely, and I suspect I'll slip into using it quite loosely at points through this morning. But just a couple of definitions about what irony is. A literary technique by which the full significance of a character's words or action is clear to the audience or reader, although unknown to the character. That moment when we can see something that's going on, something that's happening in a story or a plot line, or maybe even in someone else's life, and we can see something that's going on, something that's really actually significant, and they don't quite see it for themselves. Or another understanding of irony, a state of affairs or an event that seems deliberately contrary to what one expects and is often wryly amusing as a result. I don't know about you, I don't know if it's everyone's experience, but certainly I feel at points my life has had some reasonably kind of ironic twists to it. Sometimes it's just the small things in a day, just those things where in fact did not quite turn out how you might have expected it to go. And I'm usually happy laughing at myself and my own stupidity, so I usually find it wryly amusing as a result. But those who've been in the church for a while might remember when I first came to the church and came and shared my story of how it was I'd ended up at the point of being called to this church. And actually both times I've ended up giving that story, I began it by saying I did not want to be here. And for me that journey was one of actually God changing my expectations. Before Kate and I came to Slough, we'd been to visit a lovely church down on the south coast of England, by the sea. It was all very nice, and we went there and explored for a couple of days, possibly going and being part of that church. And it was all very lovely, and we'd seen this job advertised at Slough Baptist Church, and we thought, well, we'll drop in one Sunday morning, and we'll go and just kind of see, and we won't like it, and it will help us feel better about this other place that we're looking to go. And there were things that we didn't like about the idea of moving to Slough, I'll be honest, but God seemed to have other plans, and in the end we did find it wryly amusing as a result. Sometimes there's some irony, isn't there, in our own stupidity, sometimes in our own foolishness. We can perhaps laugh at ourselves at a point and see, well, just how stupid maybe we've been. But sometimes we do really get ourselves caught up, messed up in things, tied up in things, and we miss something of what God really has for us through our own misdirection, through being caught up in things that aren't the fullness of life of what he has for us. I see a sense of irony as this, just earlier in John 18, you can easily look at it if you've got your Bibles open, because you see this kind of interplay between Peter denying Jesus while Jesus is telling the truth. Earlier on in John 18, a young girl comes to Jesus and says, "You aren't one of this man's disciples too, are you?" And he says, "I am not." He comes and he lies, he denies who Jesus is. And meanwhile, in the middle of that, we've got Jesus, the one telling the truth. Jesus said, "If I said something wrong, testify that it's wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why do you strike me?" Jesus is hit and struck for being the one who is speaking the truth, for being honest to those who question him and who challenge him. Jesus is struck down for telling the truth, while Peter gets away with denying Jesus and telling lies. And the irony, of course, is so much greater from just knowing what happens a few chapters earlier in John chapter 13, where it was Peter, the one who said, "Lord, why can't I follow you? I will lay down my life for you." Peter, the one who said that he would be willing to die for Jesus, who wanted to follow him wherever it was that Jesus was going. He said he was going to be willing to follow him whatever the cost. And Jesus says, "Will you really lay down your life for me? Very truly, I tell you, before the cock crows, you will disown me three times." The irony that Jesus sees what's going to happen to Peter, and Peter doesn't see it for himself. The irony, of course, that this whole story is turning out in a very different way to what Peter expected. As they come to arrest Jesus, Peter's the one who pulls his sword and cuts off someone's ear because he's thinking that this is going to be about winning a battle, this is going to be about a revolution, something that's more military than Jesus ever had in mind. this isn't turning out the way that Peter expected. And Peter finds him at this moment, Jesus arrested, being quizzed three times as to who he is and whether he knows Jesus, whether he's following him. And he found himself, it seems like he's kind of caught like a rabbit in the headlights, kind of stunned, not expecting that this would be the way that things turned out, not expecting that this is what would happen. Not wanting to be caught up in the way that Jesus is. And he's full of fear. He's afraid. He's afraid that what's happening to Jesus is going to happen to him. He's afraid that this isn't turning out the way that he'd wanted, the way that he'd expected, the way he thought things would be. And suddenly he's caught up in his own protection. He can lie and he can protect himself. He can lie and seem to try and keep himself safe from what they might do to him, from the arrest that might face him if they found out he was one of Jesus' disciples. Would they beat him? Would they arrest him? Would he be crucified himself? And so he denies the truth. And we've got to be a little bit gentle when we come to Peter here, because the truth be told, we all know that we face the same challenges. Peter faced possibly being arrested, beaten, even killed. How easily do we deny what it means to follow Jesus for our own protection, for our own comfort, for much lesser things? It's so easy, isn't it, to betray Jesus in the way that we live our lives, even in just something so simple as being honest, whether it's at home or at work or at school. We live in a culture that generally sort of encourages us to protect ourselves. Well, it's only just bending the truth. It doesn't really matter. And everyone's doing it. If you don't do it, then you'll be disadvantaged. It will cost you. You won't look like others. You won't look as good as other people. Maybe it will just cost you money in your hand. We see the cost for Jesus. He speaks the truth and he's struck for it. And we begin to live in fear. I don't know for you what it may be that you're afraid of. But we live in fear. And as a result, we seek for our own protection, our own comfort, to keep us from whatever it may be that we are afraid of. And the irony is that where we think, where we have this fear and we try to protect ourselves from it, and we think that's going to give us life, we think that will keep us safe, the irony is that actually it stops us from finding the true life that Jesus offers. That actually we shouldn't be afraid of anything. The only one we should be afraid of is God himself. That where we live in fear, we miss the true life that Jesus can offer us. The cock crowed for Peter, and for him it was that moment where he realised what it was that he had done. That moment where he realised that actually things hadn't gone the way that he had expected, the way he realised that he had done exactly what Jesus told him he would do. And John doesn't even need to tell us in his gospel, you read it in the other gospel accounts, because you can see what's built up in Peter, that he goes outside and he weeps bitterly at what it is that he has done. We think so often that it is for us that to live in freedom, that just to do what we want, to do what pleases us, is what it is to be free. If we live in fear, we deny the truth. And the irony is that we miss true life. The irony continues when we pick up where Christine began reading to us. And maybe you spotted this. This one I find slightly wryly amusing in some ways. John chapter 18, verse 28. Then the Jewish leaders took Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, they did not enter the palace because they wanted to be able to eat the Passover. So the Jewish leaders were taking Jesus to Pilate to come and have him accused And they were trying to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, that if they were to go into a Gentile's house, into the house of someone who wasn't a Jew, it would make them ceremonially unclean. And they wouldn't be able to go into the temple and eat the Passover and share in the Passover festivities that were going on, because they would have been made unclean by doing that. That's how seriously they took that kind of ceremonial cleanliness, how seriously they took that separation from people who weren't Jewish. And so the great irony that you've got these people who are trying to avoid being unclean, who are taking someone who is innocent to try and have him executed. They're taking an innocent man to have him killed, yet they're concerned about being ceremonially unclean. They don't see what it is that they're doing. They seem to ignore the reality of what it is that they're doing. They have this glaring thing going on in their lives, and yet they seek to justify themselves. To justify themselves by going through the motions, by doing what looks right, by doing what looks good, by just adhering to religion rather than anything else. And the truth is for us is that religion cannot save. That going through the motions doesn't make a difference. That no matter how many times you attend worship, or whatever form of baptism you've had, or how often you take communion, or however long your prayers, or however much money you give, none of those things are what saves us. None of those things can make us clean with God. None of those things can cleanse us from all unrighteousness. None of those things are able to deal with or pay the price for the things that we've done wrong, for our sin. None of those things can make us right with God. We might use those things to try and soothe a guilty conscience. We might use those things because we think and we feel that they make us feel a bit better. But the irony is, although they make us feel better, they don't make us right with God. They don't make us clean. The only one who can is Jesus, the one who said he's the way, the truth, and the life. The one who said he's the one who, through him, we can come to the Father. And when we seek peace in religion, we deny that. When we go through those acts, when we do those things that come out of a life of faith, are an expression of our faith and our trust in Jesus, then all those things have some validity. They have worth. They are an expression of our love and our seeking to follow Jesus and of what he has done for us. But on their own, without faith, they're useless. They might make us feel a little bit better, but they don't make us right with God. The irony is that these religious leaders, these Jews, were coming and they were seeking peace in religion while they were killing the one who could make them clean. And then we come to Pilate. Jesus is brought before Pilate, and Pilate finds himself in the position of judging the one who is the truth. Pilate comes and asks Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Pilate's put in a bit of a difficult position because Jesus is chucked in front of him, and he doesn't like the Jewish people, he doesn't understand the Jewish people, and he's kind of been chucked, this person, by the Jewish leaders, and he tries to kind of pass him back because he doesn't feel he's got the authority, the understanding to judge them on a religious basis. But what he can judge is whether someone is a king. Pilate was like a career politician. He would get what it is, what a king is. He can understand that. And when he asks Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" he by no means in any way thinks it's true. Jesus isn't from the right place, doesn't have the right followers, doesn't have the right status to be a king. He didn't believe for a moment that it's true. And Jesus tries to explain to him that his kingdom isn't what Pilate is thinking about. "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. But now my kingdom is from another place." The Jews were under the authority of Rome. They were subject to Rome. Pilate himself got his authority from the emperor. Their authority came from earthly places. Jesus was saying his authority came from somewhere else. That his authority came from God. That's why this wasn't a victory that was going to be won through a military uprising, through conquering, through taking out the previous leader, through some kind of revolt in that way. It wasn't going to be something that could be won through a sense of earthly power. The only uprising that Jesus was going to have was his rising from the grave. His victory wasn't going to be over an army, but was going to be over sin and death itself. He's trying to say his kingdom isn't something that comes from a sense of earthly power. It doesn't mean it's got no earthly reality. Of course, Jesus is the one who told us to pray that his kingdom would come on earth as it is in heaven. The kingdom that Jesus is talking about is something that very much impacts our world today. That should impact our lives too. Pilate says to him, well, you are a king then. And Jesus tries to explain that he's not the kind of king that Pilate thinks of. You say that I'm a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came into the world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me. All around there's the sense of lies and deception of Peter denying Jesus, of the Jewish trying to come and the Jewish leaders trying to come and get Jesus executed on false charges, and the kind of deceptive statements and words that they use. All around there's lies, and there's Jesus in the middle of it saying, I'm the one who is the truth. I've come to testify to the truth. He's come to speak of reality, of what the world is really about, to say that a close personal relationship with God is really possible through me. That I'm the way, the truth, and the life, and you can come to the Father through me. As Jesus talks about the truth, John points us back to what we read in John chapter 8, or what we find in John chapter 8. John chapter 8, verse 31. To the Jews who'd believed him, Jesus said, if you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. When Jesus talks about being the one who came to testify to the truth, he was talking about himself. I am the truth, Jesus tells us. Jesus says, by knowing me, you can be set free. The Jews he was talking to didn't understand it. They didn't get what he was talking about. So he goes on to explain it a bit more a couple of verses later. He says, very truly I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now, a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. Everyone who sins is a slave to sin. As I said a moment ago, we so often think that freedom is the freedom to do whatever you want, as long as it doesn't harm other people too much. That's what we think of freedom is. Just do whatever you feel. But Jesus says, actually, when you just do whatever you feel, whatever you want, you don't realise that you're a slave to sin. You're a slave to your own desires and cravings and what gratifies yourself. He says, you don't realise that you've been enslaved. And so that I can come and set you free. That I'm the son of my Father. A slave doesn't have a permanent place, but if I set you free, then you really will be free. You can even be part of my family. And the irony is here, you've got Jesus bound, weak, deserted by those who'd followed him, against Pilate, who's in charge, who's in authority. Who's the one who's going to make the decision about whether Jesus lives or dies? And you've got the one who is weak and imprisoned, offering his judge freedom. He offers him the truth, that the truth will set him free. And Pilate responds, what is truth? Well, what is truth then? Pilate's the one who's the judge, and he's the one who's going to ask the questions. Pilate's the one who's in authority. Pilate's the one who's in charge. And perhaps sometimes this is our own issue ourselves, that we're the one who asks the questions. That we have a sense, in some ways, of perhaps at points of our own arrogance. That we're the ones who ask the questions. That when we come to the Bible, when we come to our faith, when we come to God, well, actually, we're the ones who wants to ask the questions. We come from that position of our own, perhaps viewing our own authority. And I'm not for a moment saying that we shouldn't ask questions about our faith, that we shouldn't ask questions about what the Bible says, that we shouldn't explore those things. We should, of course, have a faith that seeks understanding. But I think the problem is when we come from that position of only asking our own questions. And we don't allow him to ask questions of us. So often when we see people come and ask Jesus a question, he responds by asking them a question back. Even Pilate here, when he comes to him and says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus says, "Is that your own idea? Or is that something that someone else has told you about?" So often Jesus comes and we ask him a question and he wants to ask us one back. And are we willing to listen to the questions that he asks us? Are we willing to allow him to speak into our lives and challenge us? Or do we come from such a position of our own arrogance, authority, our own judgment, that we won't allow him to question us? And our final bits of irony come at the end of the passage, where Pilate says, "It's your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of Passover. Do you want me to release the king of the Jews?" They shouted back, "No, not him. Give us Barabbas." Now Barabbas had taken part in an uprising. I find a bit of irony is the guilty is released and the innocent man is condemned to death. A bit of irony is Pilate seems to miscalculate what's going on. But it seems like Pilate perhaps thought if they came and gave the crowds the option that Jesus had been so popular, that surely if he comes to the crowds and says, "Do you want Jesus back?" The Jewish leaders, they've just been jealous of him, jealous of all these people following him. Then if I bring him to the crowds, they'll release him, they'll set him free. And Pilate miscalculates. Whereas we know it's all part of God's plan. And we look back to what was said just a little bit earlier in chapter 18 that points us back to something that was said even earlier in John's Gospel, that Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jewish leaders that it would be good if one man died for the people. Who made that statement and didn't understand the full significance of what it was he was saying. Because we see Jesus, the innocent one, condemned to death, that one man would die for all the people. That Jesus comes and makes a way for our freedom. But perhaps sometimes we get so caught up in lies that we miss the truth. That sometimes we get so caught up in what it is that maybe we are afraid of for ourselves. What it is that we are fearful of. We seek our own protection and we don't enter into the truth and the freedom that Jesus has for us. Sometimes we get so caught up in the things of going through the motions of religion that make us soothe us a little bit, that make us feel a little bit better, that we won't come to Jesus and really be set free. They make us feel a little bit better, and so that we don't perhaps have to face the reality of what it is that we've done, the reality of our own sinfulness, the reality perhaps of the shame that we might feel. And we just try and soothe it a little bit. And we miss the freedom that's offered to us in Jesus Christ of forgiveness, of a life free from shame. That we come to him with so much of our own judgment, with our own questioning, with what it is that we want, with what it is that we want to ask, with what it is we want to know. And that we don't ask, allow him to speak to us. That we judge for ourselves and we don't let the truth be the one who judge us. We come and we don't realise how wanting we are and how we are in need of his salvation. That we get so tied up in fear, in religion, in judgment, that we won't really allow the truth to set us free. And yet the truth, as we come through this passage, as we come through the next couple of weeks, as we continue journeying through John, is the truth is that Jesus is dying to set you free. That Jesus was willing to offer himself for you, so that you could be set free, so that you didn't have to be afraid. So that you can know that you're forgiven. So there need not be any shame. So that you can be made clean. So that you can know God and be in relationship with him. and hear his voice and know what he wants to say to you. So perhaps it's time to let go of whatever it is that holds you. Whatever it is that has caught you up. Whatever it is that's stopping you from knowing Jesus, who is the truth, and walking with him. Jesus said, if you know the truth, if you know him, he was talking about himself, know who he is, and he is the one who will set you free. And we've got some time together now, as we come and Christine leads us and we share together in communion, to remember him, to invite him to meet with us, so that we might know him more, and we might know the freedom that he can bring. Thank you, Christine.